Welcome to The Art of Authenticity, a weekly podcast that explores what it really means to be authentic and build a life that's truly you, featuring in-depth interviews with successful business leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, and thinkers. By sharing their stories, daily practices, and habits, they will help you find a life that is successful and authentic. I'm your host, Laura Coe, author, entrepreneur, and coach. Welcome to the show. Welcome to this episode with Tim Grawl, best-selling author and entrepreneur. Tim started a business to help authors build their platforms and connect to their readers. I actually know all about his work because Tim helped me when I was just starting out. His approach to the shifting publishing landscape is so cutting edge, and I can personally talk to it because having worked with him, it was extremely effective and a ton of fun. If you're interested in the changing world of publishing, Tim will shed light on what he has seen in his nearly 10 years in the publishing industry. Plus, he shares tips for authors trying to build an audience. But what I know you're going to love the most in this episode is how much Tim shares about his journey to an authentic life through his personal stories and getting clear on what really matters to him. So I hope you enjoy the show. And if you like what you hear, please subscribe and write a review. Thanks for listening. Hi, Tim. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to it.
I am very grateful that you've joined us. And I am so excited to talk to you today because for those of you out there, Tim was the very beginning entry point. I don't know if you know this, Tim, but you you were the first point in my journey in the self-publishing world. I left my job and I wanted to write a book, and I thought the hardest part, and truthfully the part I really struggled with, was the actual writing, sitting down, trying to get the, you know, words on paper, all the fears that come up with it, everything that a writer struggles with, I think I struggled with. And that was what I really thought was my big obstacle, but I had no idea. You know, the publishing world has shifted and changed so much, and I was really in for a ride to this world of platforms. And thankfully, somebody introduced me to you, and we talked, and you helped consult me. And I think I took notes like I was in high school. Every word you said, I was like hanging on. I'm like, what's a platform? What's a blog post? What, how do I do evergreen and mailing lists? And, so helpful. And your work is just incredible for new authors out there because, as I said, the industry has shifted so much and it's just it's a big learning curve. So I'm excited to talk to you because I'm curious. I don't know, you know, how did you get involved in this? You know, you must have been one of the early people in this new platform world for authors.
Well, so I started back probably 11, 12 years ago. I started a blog in the biking world. I was working at a job, not making much money, and I had gotten into mountain biking. And I promise this will get to writing. And so I started this blog because me and my buddy had these really crappy bikes and no money to buy new equipment. And we're like, hey, you know, we had heard of these blog things. They were just coming on the scene. We're like, maybe if we start a website, we can get free stuff from companies and just review them on the website. But the only way that you can actually do that is if you have people reading your website. And so it kind of launched me into this space where I had to figure out how to get people to pay attention to what I was doing. So I had gone to school to be a programmer. I knew how to build websites and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't know how to get people to pay attention to it. So I just kind of dove headlong into that. And that really got my feet wet and learning how to build something that people will pay attention to. And I ended up growing that into 5 different websites and a network and sold it. And then I was just freelancing, doing, you know, building websites and doing online marketing for kind of anybody that would give me money to do that. So whether it's a big company or it's, you know, just one person, you know, whatever kind of came across my desk. But I reached this crossroads where I had these two projects. I had this one project that should have been a dream for my little company. At this point, it was me and one employee, And we had this pretty big company hire us to do their online store, and they paid us a lot of money to do it. And we did it, and it worked fine, and everything worked, except that it was just an excruciating process. You know, working for a company where you go in and, you know, there's nine different people in the room who all have an opinion. And like, I kept having to sit through these meetings, and it was just killing me.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I had started working for a couple authors. I had started working, I'd helped on Ramit Sethi's book launch that went to the New York Times bestseller list. I had started working for Hugh McLeod and Dan Pink, you know, all of these are some of my heroes and people I loved reading. And I reached this crossroads where it's like, I can either keep working with authors, even though, you know, overall they can't pay as much, or I can keep trying to get bigger and bigger clients. And I just felt like I wanted to work with authors. I'd always been a big reader. I felt like, you know, most of my entertainment and education came from books. And so the idea of getting to work with authors full time was just a dream come true. And so I just switched my company over and took all the knowledge I had of building platforms, both the tech part and the marketing part, and just went headlong into figuring out what are the best ways that authors can build their platform, connect with readers, and sell more books.
And I can't imagine there was very many people in the space doing this work. I mean, were you one of very few people working in this model?
Yeah, it was interesting. We grew pretty fast because there wasn't a lot of people in this space. But at the same time, the struggle was that most, and still surprisingly, in traditional publishing, they just don't see this as a need or as their responsibility. So an author kind of has to realize like, oh, my job is to market my book. My job is to build my own platform. And then they find us and work with us and love us. But at the time, you know, this was 8-ish years ago, I guess. And, you know, this still was like such a new thing. Very few authors were taking it seriously. And so, you know, I had the Dan Pinks and the Ramit Sethis, but like I would talk to most authors. I had many authors literally tell me like, oh, that's my publisher's job.
Right.
And, you know, you can argue whether or not it's their job, but there's no argument that they're just not going to do it. Like it's your responsibility to sell your own book, whether you're self-published or traditionally published. So yeah, so I started doing that and just figuring out, you know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, the 80-20 thing. Like I want to the 20% of work that gets me the 80% of results. So I constantly was testing new stuff, like testing social media, testing email lists, testing blogs, testing different ways of launching a book, testing different types of books, and just ended up I've now worked with hundreds authors one-on-one, you know, train thousands more online, and I just aggregate everything I learn. You know, I don't look at it as like I know all this stuff. What it's been is I just come up with ideas and throw it against the wall with all of my clients and see what works and continue to just refine what I do.
And it's shifting all the time. No, with new technologies coming out. I mean, now video blogs are, you know, they've been bigger, right? It feels to me like you also have to be flexible and try new things.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the things that I came across, and this is in my first book, is just this kind of framework I run everything through. You know, so every platform needs a way to have permission to stay in contact with people long term. They need a way to bring in new people, and they need a way to connect with new people and bring in new people. So I call it outreach, content, and permission. And so then what I'm that just works. Like that kind of system works. You have to have a way to meet new people, a way to develop them, and then a way to stay in contact with them long term. And then once you have that, you can just continue to grow that over a long period of time. So then as all of this new stuff comes in, whatever the new thing is, I just kind of fit it into that framework and figure out like, okay, is it helping with one of those things? And then I test it with a bunch of different things if it works. And so it's funny because people assume because I'm in the online marketing space, like I must be doing everything. Like I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook and I'm doing Facebook page and Facebook advertising. And then I'm on Pinterest and now I'm, you know, doing the Periscope and I'm doing, you know, like doing all these different things. I'm like, no, I pretty much still only do like two or three things because every time I try that new stuff, it's the 80% of work that gets the 10 or 20% of results. And so I'd rather just do the handful of things that keep working and I keep trying new things. And if it works, I'll keep doing it. But I just don't automatically do stuff that's new because most of the stuff, it's going to just fizzle out and not work.
So you've mentioned a couple times this idea of testing things. What is your test process? How do you know when something's working?
Well, I kind of just rip off the whole scientific method. You know, if you just Google like the scientific method, there's like six or seven steps. And it's kind of, you were taught it in high school and everything. I mean, it's once people hear it, they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, it's just as simple as like, okay, I need something, right? So in my case, I'm always trying to build my email list and we can talk about that if you want. But so I want to grow my email list. Okay. So I come up with a hypothesis of how I think I can grow my email list. So I think I can grow my email list by doing more stuff on Twitter. Okay, well, what stuff am I going to do on Twitter? And I come up with a bunch of ideas. Then I go out and I try that stuff long enough to see if it's actually growing my email list. If it's not, I stop doing it. If it is, I keep doing it.
Yeah.
And then after I've tested it long enough, I just stop and I say, okay, is this working? And if the answer is no, I mean, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's no, this isn't working. Then I'm like, okay, well, let me come up with a new hypothesis. Like, was I doing Twitter wrong or does Twitter just not work? And should I try something else? So it's very straightforward. And to me, it's kind of like, I don't know why people just don't do things this way because most of the people I meet are running around doing 100 different things and they don't know if any of it's working. And what I've found is if I go slow and methodical and just continue to kind of chip away at new things and see what works and what doesn't, then I find the things that work. I keep doing those things and then I keep trying new things. It's much better because then I know that the majority of what I'm spending my time on at any given time is actually getting me closer to my goals.
So I have to ask then, with all your tests, what is the best way to build an email list? And for those of you out there who are not familiar, or you're an author writing a book, thinking about writing a book, or you have a friend, it's all about this email list and how do you grow it so that you have a group of people that you can reach out to with permission on a regular basis. And it is an art form to try to figure out. What have you found has been the best way to grow that list?
Well, so I haven't talked about this publicly anywhere yet. So I've actually in the last...
The scoop.
In the last 3 weeks, I've grown my list from 14,500 to 22,500. So I've added over 50% and that's wrong. It's actually 30,000 because I'm adding another list. Anyway, so I've gone from 14,500 to 30,000 and I should be at 40,000 by the end of February.
Whoa.
And but the way that I did this, it's not everybody's going to like the answer to how to do this. And then we can come back and I can give you practical ways that more people could use. But the idea is I have this online course called Launch a Better. And it's a course that has 3 different levels. There's a $1,000 version, a $2,000 version, and a $5,000 version. So I have that course and I'm opening it up for registrations in February. And so I wanted a way that I could really incentivize other people to help build my list so that I could sell that course in February. So I wrote a new book called Book Launch Blueprint, the step-by-step guide to a best-selling launch. And I put it up on Amazon. It's $10 on Amazon. But I gave it away through my own list, but I also recruited what's called JV partners, which is joint venture partners, that other people that have email or authors. And I said, hey, give my book away. And everybody that signs up for my email list, if they buy the course come February, I'll give you half of anything I make. And so now they're really incentivized to get people on my list, because if they get people on my list and those people buy something from me, they get half of that money. And it's a really good deal for them, because all they did was send a couple emails promoting a free book. And then 2 months later, I turn that into money and I send them half of any money that I make. And so that has been the biggest, like, I had no idea it would work this well, that I would literally quadruple, I guess, almost quadruple the size of my list by the time I'm completely done with this.
Amazing.
3X my list.
That's amazing. Anyway, and for people who aren't part of like a joint venture, like what could they do?
Yeah, so I have different, I basically have different strategies based on where people are at in the process. So I'm actually working with a guy. I've helped him in the last several months go from zero people to he just broke 500 people on his email list. And so if you're at zero, and, you know, to me, the first 1,000 is the hardest part, you know, going from zero to 1,000. So to get your first 100 people, this is what I tell people, because, so I'll give you the two pieces of advice I tell people, and I'll tell you why I give this advice. The first is get everybody you know on your email list. So get your Facebook friends, your Twitter followers, your colleagues, your bloggers, your friend with, you know, whoever that might be interested in your topic. Just send them an email and say, I'm starting an email list. Can I add you? I think you'll really like it. If at any time you want to unsubscribe, you can just unsubscribe. 99% of people will say yes. And you just add them one at a time. Like, I think most people should go from 0 to 100 by adding them one at a time by hand, because it gets you really, really comfortable with asking people to join your email list. And to move from 0 to 100 to 1,000 to 14,000 to 50,000, you've got to get really comfortable just inviting people to be a part of your email list. So that's the first thing.
Yeah, I remember working with you, and I just think you made this point probably every other sentence, that, you know, the pop-ups are really important on the website, like the submit for the email, yeah, yeah. Right? And it is. And I was very uncomfortable with it at first. And I think, again, authors in particular, I think are even more uncomfortable putting themselves out there in that way. But it's true and it works. And people are so much more generous and open than you anticipate. It's not as stressful as I thought.
Yeah. And I mean, I still deal with some of this. Like, so at this point, I've given away almost 12,000 copies of my new book. And like, I'm getting emails every hour of people saying they like it. And I'm at like 144 reviews on Amazon. And like, still, I'm like, really? They like what I do? Like, that still surprises me, you know? So it's not like I'm all of a sudden immune from all of the same fears. I've just kind of learned how to put them in a box and put them on a shelf so I can do what I need to do.
Yeah.
And
so to get from 1,000 to 2,000, 5,000, you say is easier. Why is that?
Well, so my first book, the first 1,000 copies, and the why I picked the number 1,000 is that almost anybody can sell about 250 copies of their book. And the reason why that there's that number 250 is you probably know that many people, right? So if you just kind of work your network, you can usually sell a couple hundred copies of your own book. But if you sell 1,000 copies, that means roughly 750 of those people don't know you. They bought the book without personally knowing you. And that's important, because that means you have figured out a way, you have some kind of system in place to get people that don't know you to buy your book. And the same thing goes for your email list. Is like, so I encourage people to get to 100 from the people they know, and then start doing a couple things that will get them to 1,000. And if you can get to 1,000, you then are getting 900 people that don't know you to sign up for your email list. And that's really important, because now you've figured out some kind of system. And so adding another 1,000 is just continuing to do what you did to get to 1,000 to do it better.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned at the beginning somebody self-publishing versus somebody who has a book deal. And the truth is that both people at this point need a platform. You have to have a website. And as great as your publisher is, you know, bookstores don't exist, and it's really important to get your messages out there. When people go through this process, though, it's overwhelming. What was the hardest lesson you learned in creating your platform, doing your book, you know, launching? Was there one thing in particular that, you know, surprised you that was more difficult or what have you?
Yeah. So when I came, I was surprised at the emotional side of coming out with a book. So I had worked with authors for years before I wrote my own book. And I would hear them, you know, they would talk to me about like, oh, my book's so hard to write, and oh, I'm stuck on this thing. And then when it, you know, and then when it came time to launch, they'd be like, oh, I don't know, I feel uncomfortable promoting it. And, like, there was just this part of me that's like, just get over yourself and do it. And then, like, when it came time to do my own book, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't want to do this. And like, I kept off and I kept like, and there was this point where like, I was literally looking at the files on my computer and I'm like, if I delete this right now, nobody will ever have to know. Like, you know, a handful of people that knew I was working on the book, but otherwise I could just like, it never, and there, I actually, it was funny. I had a client recommend that I journal through the process. So I did, just thinking it would be just for me. And then after my book came out, so many people kept saying things like, you know, oh, you're the book marketing guy, you must have been so confident going into your book launch. I'm like, I was freaking out. And so actually, if you go to my website, timgraal.com, under the resources section, there's my journal. I posted as a PDF that you can actually read. And I think a little bit about that, like, I want to just delete the book is in there. Yeah. So I was surprised at how emotional I got. You know, everybody wants to be the author that sold a lot of copies of their book, but they don't want anybody to actually read it and judge it.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And so it's that whole like constant pull between like, I want my work to go out into the world. I want people to buy this book. I want people to read it. I know it's good for them. I know it's going to make the world a better place. But at the same time, I'm putting something out that's like, it's really scary. And it's not just like selling some widget off an assembly line somewhere. Like, people are going to judge it. And, you know, anybody can just read it and put a 1-star review on Amazon. And then I'm going to drink all night and it's just going to be bad. And, you know, and it's like, so it's like all of that stuff. It was surprising to me. What I found is, and I've seen this working with clients as well, is like, you know, so many times it's not pulling the right lever, like which levers to pull, you know, marketing wise to get things to work. It's like just coming up with the like emotional fortitude to pull them even when you really, really, really don't want to.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly good advice. And, you know, on the book front, I was told there's really no finished book, only an abandoned book. And I think in the end, you're putting out something that it's a work in progress all the time, because you're always learning. And at no time do you feel like this thing is finished. So it's so hard to finish. And, you know, somebody recommended, I'm sure you read it, Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art, right? And such a simple book, but I think the message of that resistance, right? It was the reason I think it sold so much, was it's such a powerful idea that as you put yourself, your real, you know, vulnerable thoughts on to the page and then put them out into the world, that you're really putting yourself up for criticism.
Yeah. And I will tell you, it gets easier.
Yes, it does.
You know, it's definitely a muscle that you just work. And what I love about Stephen Pressfield's book and what I've learned is personifying is really helpful, because now I actually like have a picture in my head of what my resistance looks like the person, like what it wears and like what it looks like. And like when I come up against it, I pretend like I'm fighting a person and not myself. And I've learned that with a lot of things, if I can kind of like pull them outside of myself and set them out on the table so that we can have an honest discussion about it, things get a little bit easier. Because so many times, and there's 100 different ways to do this, you know, journaling, seeing a counselor, seeing a therapist, talking to a friend, 100 different ways to do this, but so many times we have these like loops just running in our head that are just killing us. And like just, oh, you know, it's funny, just so back in June, I did this big launch of my product. It sold four times. It made four times as much money as I'd ever made on a product launch. And then I, you know, was all excited and it worked really well. And I, you know, I just couldn't have been happier. And then I kind of stopped working, and it was nice for a couple of months to take a break. And then I worked on a project that was like a bad project, and I knew it was a bad project, but I did it anyway. And then I was sitting at breakfast, this was just a few months ago, with a friend, and he started like listing off a couple of ways that I could continue to make money on something. And I kept like pushing back on him. And then finally I'm like, you know what? I feel guilty making more money. And I realized like, I had this installed in me in my youth that, your output should equal your input. So the amount of money you make should be directly correlated to the amount of effort you put in.
Yeah.
And so, and now I had, my output had so far surpassed my input, 'cause I don't work that much, that I felt guilty trying to make more money.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it until I sat down and had conversations with people about it. And then I could see it and be like, that's evil. Like, I can't believe that anymore. And then I can move past it.
You're speaking my language. This is emotional layers with Tim Grawl today. Yeah, absolutely. it's like, it's amazing that these things sit there and we don't notice it and we live with it. And then one day you say, oh my God, I can't believe I have this learned, I call them imposter thoughts, right? Just sitting there weighing me mm-hmm. down. And what I love is that almost always my clients, they don't believe it. They are just thinking it unconsciously, right? They don't even know that the thought is there. And when they look at it, it's like, wow, I don't know that I think that that's true.
Yeah. You know, I feel like, and I'll be interested in your take on this, because I've thought about this a lot, because I've actually like the last 2 years have been very strong on me finding, like, I didn't think I had any of those things. And I found like eight of them that were destroying my life and had to go to therapy to work through them and all this stuff. And what I feel like is that they're installed at such a young age and usually reinforced by your family and your peers or whatever at such a young age that you don't even know it's weird.
Right.
Like, you don't even know there's another way that you can live. Like, I work with a lot of guys that, now I work with a lot of people that are homeless or were recently homeless. But for a while, I was working with guys in jail. And, you know, I'd have talks with them, and they honestly did not know that there is another alternative from fighting if somebody disrespects you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was installed in them. And like, to me, if somebody says something disrespectful to me, I'm just like, well, they have the problem. Like, I don't even worry about it. But it was. And so when I say like, oh, no, you don't have to fight, they're like, yes, I do. And I'm like, why? They're like, that's just what you do. I'm like,
right.
That makes no sense. You know, and it's like, but it was, it's never even been offered as an alternative. And I saw that in myself of like all of these things that I never even thought to consider. It was like breathing. It was like, I never even stopped to consider, maybe I shouldn't be breathing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No,
does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I think between myself, you know, I was in my corporate job that I didn't really like. I'd had a child, and something about being around my son, seeing how authentic and how honest, you know, I joke with clients and I'll say, if you're around children, the funniest thing about kids is you say, do you like pizza? You know, almost every kid likes pizza, but pick something that you know is a yes. And they say, yeah. And you say, are you sure you like pizza? They're like, yes. And you're like, are you really sure? And they'll jump up and down with joy. Yes, I'm sure. Right. If you do that to adults, you know, are you sure you like that movie, right? Like, within minutes, it starts to erode our self-confidence. And then we start thinking, maybe I shouldn't like it. Is there something wrong with it? Like, we have lost so much connection to our authentic core. And, you know, it's what got me motivated to write the book about emotional weight and layers, because, right, they're there. And what I think is the most interesting part about them is they take on your voice. So the things you're thinking in your head, they don't come from the person, the source that that it originated. So your mother who put it in your head that, you're really sloppy, or whatever it is that you learned as a child. It now doesn't sound like the mother. It sounds like you. It's taken on your voice. It's in your head, and you can't distinguish it from your authentic self. And I think once you learn how to turn inward, question those belief systems, like you said, put it out on the table, write it down. There's a million ways to do it. But really confront those imposter voices. They're very easy to get rid of. And you don't have to live with the stress or weight of those ideas.
Yeah, and that's another thing that when I first realized this, it took me, when I first came up against my big one, my first big one a couple years ago, it took me about 6 months to shed it. And this last one where I told you about feeling guilty. Now, that's not a huge one as far as like the way that it ran my life, but like it immediately dropped off as soon as I saw it.
Yeah, because once you realize you can change them, right? Once you get used to changing your narratives, it's much easier to do it the next time, right? Did you find yourself, once you had conquered a few of them, you're like, oh, I can change my mind on things. I don't have to stress out so much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been amazing to see that even that is a learned thing I can learn.
Yeah, it's like say, you know, it's like building a muscle, you know, we talked about it with writing, putting yourself out there. I think questioning the narratives in your mind, it's also like building a muscle. You get better and better at it. And over time, you can notice something, get rid of it the same day, if you're willing to, you know, not be too attached.
Yeah, you know, now the thing I deal with is constantly being paranoid that I have other narratives that I can't see.
That's awesome. I've never heard that one.
Yeah, because it's like, so 2.5 years ago, I had a big one and, you know, worked through that. And then I came up against another one right after that and worked through that. And then maybe 3 months later, I came up with like, I hit another one that was just huge. And what was bad was that between dealing with the first one and the third one, I kept saying, what else am I missing? And I thought, no, I'm good. I've dealt with everything. And this one was just eating me alive and I didn't even see it. Mm. And so like now I'm constantly like, oh, what am I missing? Like, you know, I'm just now that's my paranoia is what narratives I'm missing.
You know, I feel so strongly about this because I, you know, for our physical health, right? We can jump on a scale. We can go to the doctor. There's so many ways that we can test and evaluate where we are physically with our health. But how do you really evaluate your emotional health, right? I mean, we say things like, am I happy? But it's tough. I mean, I created an emotional scale as an effort to help people, you know, weigh their emotional states and figure out which ones are problematic. But I think you're right. It's a very difficult process to locate these little gremlins. My friend now calls them a little emotional fat pads that he's like, I keep running into new ones.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I've done is I constantly look for things because, I look for anything I'm hiding. So there was like a lot of my stuff, I would keep it from the people in my life. And it was funny because the things I was keeping from them wasn't like these big hairy things, like, you know, like addicted to cocaine or something, you know, right. Like they were just like, but it was my constant wanting to control situations that would keep things hidden. And so one of the things I did to break out of this is anytime. And it was really funny at first because like anytime I would catch myself wanting to hide something, I'd immediately stop what I was doing, either call my wife or go to the other side of the house and find her and just vomit it on her.
That's awesome.
You know, like, here's the thing I don't want, you know, and like now I've gotten a little like better at it. But, you know, that's one of the things that I think I learned through the process is like, what am I hiding? Like, what am I afraid to share with people? You know, for me, that was a big thing that came out of that was a lot of my issues were what I could find them by digging into what I was afraid to share.
Well, this makes for a perfect transition into the heart of this podcast really is about, you know, success and authenticity, right? And obviously, Tim, you've had a lot of success. You've written multiple books and you have a podcast and you have a new book coming out, which I still want to talk about. But since we've moved into this authenticity, I just want to continue with this for now. You've clearly put a lot of work into this. You've thought about how to find a life that feels good to you. How do you define it? How do you define an authentic life? What does living truly as yourself mean to you?
So, you know, you told me you're going to ask me this question and it's been like rolling around in my mind because it's hard to explain. So I quit March. So we're in January and March will be, 10 years since I quit my job to work for myself. And I did that 2 months after my first son was born and my wife wasn't working. So I just decided to pick apparently the most stressful time in my life to do it. But I made some promises to myself early on that I wanted freedom. That was my goal. And so everything, as much as I possibly could, I would bend towards freedom. And freedom to me is defined as nobody can tell me what to do but me. And so what I started doing was, as long as my bills were paid, like as long as I was fulfilling the obligations that I had signed up for, which is I have a wife that doesn't work outside the home and 2 kids and a mortgage and all that stuff. As long as I was fulfilling those things, if I had a choice between money and freedom, I would choose freedom over money. And that shows up in thousands of small decisions. And so I decided early on that's what I wanted my life to look like, was freedom. And so I just kept defaulting to that every chance I got. So I work with some big name authors. And some of them travel a ton to speak, and some of them absolutely love it, and a couple of them absolutely hate it. And they're making huge amounts of money, and they're very well known and popular, but they're not happy because they're spending all their time on the road, and that's not what they want. But early on, they made decisions to choose money over what they actually wanted.
Yes. Yeah.
What I did was constantly default to freedom. And for, 8 years, I would get it in little doses. And then earlier this year, I had an opportunity to sell my consulting business and start doing, writing books and coming out with online programs as my full-time thing. And I just do it by myself. And then overnight, I went from having clients that I was on call with and having employees and payroll and, an office space and all that to completely on my own again. No clients. Nobody can just pick up the phone and assume that I'm going to answer. And I have projects. I get to 100% get to pick the projects I want to work on and the things that are interesting to me. And even still, I hear the siren call of more money. Like I could do more. I could hire people. I could make more money. I could leverage this. And I have people in my life that are telling me that that's what I should do. But I've gotten really good at it now of like, no, I want freedom. And so freedom to me is after my launch in June, I didn't work for 2 or 3 months.
Yeah,
and nobody could call me and tell me I had to work. And so I feel like my path to that was making a decision of what I wasn't going to bend on. I decided what was important to me. Like one of the promises I made to Candace, my wife, when I started working for myself, would always be home at 5 o'clock to have dinner with the family. And if I had to work again, I would work at night after the kids were in bed. And so, and I stuck to that. Like, I think there was maybe once or twice that I like could not get home in time for dinner. And so, I made these decisions early on, what is important to me. And I was unbending on them. You know, even now, like I would give up freedom. If all of a sudden everything I'm building just like falls apart and doesn't make any money, like I'd go get a job and I'd work an 8 to 5 and, you know, I'd do what I had to do to pay the bills. You know, but once that threshold is kept, I don't bend on my decisions that I made a decade ago.
Yeah, I think this is such an important subject because as we look at successful people, we think, you know, the more money people have, the happier they are. And I love your example of the authors out there who are touring and disliking it just for more money. And this question of short-term happiness where, yes, you have money to go out to a restaurant and buy that one more jacket, or some people, you know, it's crazy, buy a third house or a fourth house. It's not the same as that happiness you get, that contentment from living your life in a way that makes sense for you. And, you know, in your case, having the freedom to do the creative work that you want to do. And I think people make that mistake very often, that the short-term pleasures outweigh the value of following what really, you know, deeply matters to you. And like I said, in your case, freedom to be a creative. Yeah.
And, you know, and then on a more personal note, like I get to do, like right now I'm sitting in the basement of a restaurant called The Cookery in Nashville. This is where my office is. And The Cookery is a nonprofit where the entire kitchen staff is recently homeless guys. And so we give them a place to live, job skills, and this whole 7-month program to where they can then move on and, like, you know, pick themselves back up. And we moved to Nashville just to work with them. And the reason I was able to do that was because of this freedom. And my whole plan from the beginning was, as I get freedom, I would give it back to things like this.
That's awesome.
And so, you know, so again, yeah. And, but it's what's so hard is that, 'cause I was just talking to a friend of mine who's extremely successful, but he's constantly dealing with this where he sees other people's success. And I say, here's how I say it. I say, it's really easy to get jealous of somebody else's calling.
Yeah.
You know, like you see what they're doing out in the world and you want to be that.
Yeah.
And, but you just can't. So for instance, this friend of mine is like, he has a family and his wife doesn't want him on the road all the time, but he sees all these people being successful with speaking. And so he wants to do that. And I'm like, do you actually enjoy, like, is this actually what you want out of life? He's like, well, you know, but here's why it's so awesome. And I'm like, okay, you know, like you just, yeah, you can't do that. So it's hard to tease that apart of what's your calling and what somebody else is calling. You know, like I get jealous of people that have, like, you know, you meet these people and they just have this vision, right? Like the Steve Jobs of the world that just see the world that doesn't exist yet. And then they go and create it. And when I try to look into the future, it's just black. Like I don't see anything, you know, like I'm way better at like working behind those people and helping them find, you know, get to their vision. And there's been so many times in my life and still I get frustrated of like, I'm like, okay, what's next? What's coming? You know, what can I, you know, do to change the world in these major ways? And I look and it's just this gaping blackness. Like, well, all right, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing, you know? And,
but that's the definition of inauthentic. I mean, that's the definition of inauthenticity, right? Is that we can only be ourselves, and some of us have certain skills and some of us have others. My brother is a little more towards the Steve Jobs side. He always dreams up stuff and I'm like, where do you get this from? You know, and you know,
yeah,
but he can't finish projects to save his life. Right. So it's the combination that's the winner. And I think my question to you would be, what does it feel like when you choose freedom over the money? When you've been in a moment where you're stressed, you're facing fear, and, you know, there's an opportunity for an inauthentic decision, and you remember this commitment to freedom, and you make that choice. Do you feel that in your body? I always think,
yeah,
you sleep well, you know, you're doing what's right for you.
The way it feels to me is, so I, in high school, I played football and I was a wide receiver. And which means I'm the guy that runs down the field and catches the ball when the quarterback throws it. And I wore these rib pads around my ribs to protect my ribs. And there was this one particular time where the ball was thrown. I jumped up. I was full outstretched, hands overhead. I caught the ball, and I was in the air when a guy at full run hit me right in my ribs. And it hit me so hard that this really thick plastic that covered those rib pads, it just cracked in half.
Oof.
So I hit the ground, and I didn't. So my coach realized I was hurt, got out to the field, was kneeling down next to me, and I still had not breathed. Like, it knocked the breath out of me so hard. Like, I really thought, I was like, Lord, I'm coming home. You know, like, I thought it was over. And so then finally it was like, you know, you feel like whenever you get your breath knocked out of you, you know, you feel like just a 1,000-pound giant sitting on your chest. And he like gets up, and all of a sudden you can breathe again. And that's what it feels like when I give up, when I decide like, okay, I'm not going to do that. I feel like I go from not being able to take a full breath to being able to take a breath.
And this just
2 weeks ago, you know, 2 weeks ago, this happened to me again. So, you know, Ryan Holiday.
Yeah.
And I found this post he did, like, all this advice about speaking. And again, I'm like, this is what I should be doing. And I'm reading this, and like, I'm just like, man, why am I not doing this? And da 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 da. And like, I'm just like going back into that old cycle, and I start feeling that restriction in my chest. And then finally I stop. I'm like, what do I want out of life? You know, and I like go through this process I go through of like, what do I want out of life? You know, is this going to get me closer to that? Is that really what I want? You know, is it okay? Like, you know, less people know who I am, and my fame is lower, and that's all okay because I have these other things that I want. And then like, as I go through that, it's like all of a sudden I can take my deep breaths again.
Oh, I love it. I mean, I'm going to steal that from you. I think that's one of the greatest stories, because I think this idea of getting the wind knocked out of you can't fully breathe. And, you know, people are breathing these shallow breaths. They feel anxious. You know, they feel the weight of the world. And it's these decisions that they're making for all these strange reasons. And when you say you have this practice in place, when you're feeling that pressure, when you're feeling the constriction, can you share any more details about, so you've made this commitment to freedom. Do you sit down? Do you journal? Like, how do you bring yourself back?
No, I used to like call somebody. I have a good friend that, his life, if I have to like pick a life that I want to emulate, it's him, because he does all these same things where like he could be this big time guy, but he rolls behind the scenes because he has it's like the life I want. And so I used to would call him. I would used to journal, and now I can do it. Like, I've done it so much now, it's just mental.
Yeah.
But it's basically, I start with, okay, what do you want out of life? Know what those are. And so I'm like, I want to be available for my kids. I don't want to have to travel. I like being with my family. I don't want to work that much. I don't want people to be able to have calls on my time. Like, I list those things out, and it's like, okay, is this thing that's stressing me out about what I, you know, quote, should be doing, is this going to get me closer to those, or is it going to get me further away? You know, forget anything else that I get. If it's not getting me closer to like my core goals, then it gets thrown out. And so then I'm thinking specifically about this speaking thing, right? So then I'm like, nope, I would have to travel. I'd have to like completely reframe my entire business to make this happen. I'd have to, you know, I'd be gone a lot, and like, I would have to do it for a while unpaid, and even the money I make, like, and I'm go through all these things. I'm like, nope, that doesn't get me closer. I'm like, okay, I don't have to do that.
And it's such an indicator that you say, is this what I should be doing? Right? Like, right, as soon as you say the word should be, it's like, start questioning, where did you get the idea that you should, right?
Yeah. My, a pastor I used to listen to, he said he had a banner in his house that said, don't should on me.
Right.
You know? And so, yeah, that's definitely the thing, but I just kind of do it mentally now, 'cause I've done it enough that like, I can be honest with myself. Like, so many times you're lying to yourself, right? You get this idea of what you want, and then you start like coming up with all these reasons of why, like, well, I shouldn't, you know, actually go after my dreams. I should go after this thing instead. And,
yeah.
And so, but once you get good, and and this has been a practice for me, but you know, once you get good at just being honest with yourself, you can kind of just do it in your head. But for a long time, I would do it out loud with somebody else. Then I would do it writing down. Now I just do it in my head. It's much, because also, you know, I'm kind of on the other side where like, I finally got that thing, you know, like you're always afraid, like this thing that you always wanted, you'll get it. And it's not that great. Like I got it. It's awesome. You know? And so like, you know, when I sold my business and then did that launch that did so well, like all of a sudden I literally woke up and was like, oh, this is what I've been striving for the last 10 years. Like, this is where I wanted to be. And then like the last 6 months have been like the most just relaxing and fulfilling months of my life. And I'm like, I'm not doing anything to screw this up. So even when I have those things, it's much easier to be like, nope, nope, I have what I want. And I just want more of this, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because my assistant who works with me all the time, he was talking about how he made this major authentic shift in his life. And he said, I feel like I'm going to sound like an infomercial, but here it goes, you know, and he's, I feel lighter. I feel at ease. I feel myself. I feel like, you know, people are more attracted to me, but I don't even care because I'm happier in my life. And it is, it's like this incredible experience to really say yes to yourself, make, you know, get clear about what matters to you and experience it. It's much better than I had envisioned. And I love that this is happening for you as well. So Tim, I want to circle back and talk to you real quickly about your new book. You're moving over to fiction. Yeah. what's going on? Are you making another, turn in your life or what's the plan?
Yeah. So, I love my work with authors and book marketing and all that. I'm going to continue to do that. But honestly, it doesn't take up all of my time anymore. And my kids are in school and like, I got time. And so, I found myself and I've written fiction off and on for about 3 years now. And, I find myself at the end of a good book or at the end of a good movie feeling like, thinking, I want to make people feel the way I do right now. Mm. You know, like I want to bring, you know, there's teaching that I believe is helpful, obviously, but then telling a story that brings people, you know, that carries people from one place to another is just an entirely different way of being a part of somebody's life. Like I'm rereading right now, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Mm-hmm. And I first read they just came out with a new one, but it was a trilogy for the longest time. And, I read it all in 1 week and they're long books. I read it all in 1 week on vacation one time. And I remember thinking, I wish if I could pick any books to go back and reread for the first time, it would be those, like to just experience again. So now it's been long enough where that's kind of what's happening. But it's just like, it's so enjoyable. And I love going through the story and like, it's just such a good book. And it just makes me feel a way that any of the nonfiction I've ever read has made me feel. And so I just want to see if I can do it. And I got talked into this because I was talking to a friend of mine and I was talking about what I should be doing next. And he's like, well, why don't you just write fiction? And my answer was because I don't know that I can be successful at it. And he's like, well, that doesn't seem like a good enough reason not to do something. and so I'm starting that in earnest and starting to write some fiction, hoping to come out with my first book this year. That's what I'm working on.
Fantastic. Well, I'm so grateful that you came here, shared so many incredible tips for new authors and just also the life of an entrepreneur and a creative. So much great advice and ideas. If people are looking for more information on what's going on with you, where can they find you?
So the best place is to go to my website, timgrahl.com. That's TIMGRAHL. It's really weird. Or Google anything close to that and you should find me. Sign up for my email list. I have a lot of stuff on book marketing there. That's pretty much where I do most of my writing. And that's where I'll do any announcements of any fiction I'm writing as well.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, and it was incredible to catch up with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope you found some value in this interview. If so, it would mean the world to me if you hit subscribe, completed an iTunes review, or shared it with a friend. Every little bit counts. I'm super grateful for every single one of you, and I couldn't be more excited to be here. Signing off, I'm Laura Koh, and I'll see you guys next week.